Thank you so very much. What a blessing to be here. Hollywood, Hollywood, Hollywood. No, I'm fine, no way. Oh, yes, very much so. I'd like to thank my new friend, dear sister, for those kind and generous remarks. I'm talking about Sister Carrie Slaughtery, who is the visionary leader of Skylight Books. Let's give her a hand again, though. We deeply appreciate your work. Very much so. And our elderly brothers and sisters of Sunset Hall, long-distance runners, struggling for justice for a long time and still making their contribution in their own distinctive and unique way. And I must say, just against the backdrop of these majestic hills of Hollywood, for someone from New Jersey, it's hard to take in. Can you hear me in the back all right? Last but not least, I do want to acknowledge my dear brother Roy Hurst, who I speak to every week for the last 2 years on the Tavis Smiley Show. I'd never seen him in the flesh, but I finally saw him. He's in the corner. Raise your hand, my brother. Young brother, brilliant brother. I think, Roy, you're too much for the electricity. And I'd like to thank each and every one of you for coming out on this lovely evening. I look forward to our conversation together. I appreciate that, brother. But even as we define what it is that we do it together, it's a democratic process. I don't believe that any one of us have any monopoly on truth, capital T, or goodness, capital G, or beauty, capital B, even though I see some beautiful folk out there. You serious candidates, but let's say beauty, small B, and you on the cutting edge in that regard. But in all seriousness, I've come to Hollywood to say something to unsettle you, to unnerve you, maybe even for a moment unhouse you, because I do not believe that we could talk about the depths of the crisis of not just American democracy and not just the limitations of the American empire, but to keep our focus as well on those Franz Fanon called the wretched of the earth. That we attempt to look at our present situation through the lens of those who have been subjugated, rendered invisible, and yet are indispensable for the revitalization of the American democratic project that can actually shatter the worst of the American empire, that can have positive impact on brothers and sisters in Africa and Asia and Latin America, across the globe. So from the very beginning, I want to start on a Socratic note. Let the helicopters fly even when you're invoking a Socratic note. Yeah, you'd be all right, yeah. What I was saying was we have to do something that cuts radically against the American grain, which is muster the courage to think critically for ourselves. That America's a market-driven business civilization that preoccupied with a mainstream that tries to render most of us into sleepwalkers. And Socratic energy is about mustering the courage to raise some very, very difficult and painful questions about America's past and present in order to accent the best of America's past for the future, and especially the precious children. I think I'm so glad to see the young gifts of heaven here. It's so nice to have children when you're having a discussion about democracy, so that the dialogue doesn't become so abstract and far-fetched that it's not connected to the future. Young folk, 100% of the future. And it affects how you go about your argument and vision when you hear a young child cry every once in a while. You see, because democratic process ought to be a little tainted, as it were, with, in fact, what we're fighting for. And especially those that many of us are willing to live and die for. It's not just a cause and an ideal, it's abstract. It's very, very concrete. But what I was saying was we live in an anti-intellectual civilization that rarely wants to raise certain kinds of questions, especially questions that will force us to examine ourselves, our society, and the world. So we begin with Socratic note doing what? Accenting forms of dogma, forms of parochialism, forms of provincialism. Dogma like free market fundamentalism. The fetishing of the unregulated market, ascribing magical powers to something created by human beings, but people act as if it falls from heaven with salvific effect. So deregulate, privatize, become the mantra over and over again, and we lose sight of substantive conceptions of public interest, the glue that holds us together, of common good, the very thing that allows us to be connected in any substantive way, you see. And a free market fundamentalism resulting in what? Unbelievable, obscene levels of wealth inequality. 1% of Americans now own 48% of the net financial wealth. That's oligarchic, plutocratic, to some degree still pigmentocratic. It's true. You got Sister Oldfront, Brother Robert Johnson, and others floating at the top, and God bless them, they worked hard, but at the same time, they're part of a structural inequality that goes hand in hand with losing sight of the fact that 20% of all of America's children live in poverty in the richest nation in the history of the world. That is a moral disgrace. 39% of brown children. 37% of black, and let's not forget the red children, the indigenous peoples. 47% of their children living in poverty. There is an escalating race inequality that results more and more in disinvestment from cities, most of those cities chocolate, into suburbs, most of those suburbs vanilla, though not exclusively. Decrepit schools. Unavailable health care and health care insurance. Hard to obtain child care. Not enough jobs with a living wage. Working people treated as if they're simply disposable commodities to be calculated in light of a profit margin, where most of the profit remains at the top of management and CEO level. What is it now? $301 for every dollar CEO, the average worker. It's called corporate greed. And it's corporate greed, why? Because when the demos, those Sly Stone call everyday people, or the late great James Cleveland call ordinary people, when their voices are not heard, when the National Negro Anthem, lift every voice, does not take place, there's no structures of accountability for those on the top. And when there's no structures of accountability for those on the top, greed usually runs amok. And there's always certain saints in every group, class, and so forth. So even among the well-to-do, you get those who say, well, I just like to make money. To make money, I want to give it all back. And that's a beautiful thing. I am deeply moved by charity. I am. Bill Gates and Melinda Gates and others give $100 million for malaria. I say I'm moved by it. But I don't confuse charity with justice. You have to talk about the structural inequality that allowed you to gain access to that kind of wealth. And think about it on the global scale. The three richest individuals in the world have more wealth than the bottom 47 countries. What are they going to say about us 100 years from now, 150 years from now? The top 225 individuals have more wealth than 47% of all of humankind. You're talking about 6.1 billion brothers and sisters of all colors. What kind of world are we bequeathing to the precious children? Well, we begin then with this dogma. It's a profoundly anti-democratic dogma operating in the precious experiment in democracy called the USA, free market fundamentalism, and very few have been willing to contest it, to examine it, to scrutinize it. And I don't trash markets. They're here to stay. They're inescapable. They're unavoidable. The problem is, like any other human creation or legal construct, they can be used for ill if there's no means by which persons are rendered responsible, answerable, accountable. And that's what American, that's what Democracy Matters is all about. How do we become responsible, accountable? And how do others become responsible, accountable, and answerable? What other dogmas? Aggressive militarism. And I'm not just talking about the recent imperial invasion that was immoral and illegal and unnecessary in Iraq. That's just the peak of an iceberg. Aggressive militarism is one in which you understand yourself as the Colossus, the Leviathan, the superpower, the hegemon, and think that somehow might makes right, that raw force and coercion is the means by which you mediate conflict. Reminds one of Plato's Republic with Thrasymachus encountering Socrates, you might recall. Socrates talking about truth, moral consistency, integrity. Thrasymachus said, that's outdated, that's played out, that's anachronistic. It's about might makes right. If we have the might, we define what's right. It's the bully mentality, imperial sensibility, and it's reflected in our everyday lives. It's tied to machismo identities. You saw the picture of Bush on one of the magazines standing like he's a gunslinger? Manifest destiny, the gunfighter nation. Conquer, dominate like Melville's Ahab and that classic written by that genius 32 years old Herman Melville. Moby Dick, 1851. That's how you make it from womb to tomb. You dominate, you conquer, you crush them. We see it on the home front. Cowardly brothers don't want to confront the boss, come home, attack the vulnerable sisters of all colors we're talking about now. All colors we're talking about. Machismo identity. That's how you make it through life. You don't organize, you don't debate, you don't mobilize, you don't bring power and pressure to bear. You fight your way through it. That's nothing but a pose and a posture. But when people are posing and posturing in that way with access to unbelievable military power, like the new hawks in the White House, like the new imperialists in the White House, then we got a problem. And of course, the irony is what? The hypocrisy is what? In part, even the very army of the American empire is disproportionately working class young people, disproportionately black and brown young people. Brother Michael Moore points that out in an exemplary way, doesn't he? Yeah. Congress, 435 members, only one of this children fighting in the war. I go to black churches and ask, how many of you all have relatives who are in the armed forces? 40, 50, 60% of them raise their hands. I remind my dear brothers and sisters at Princeton, especially the right-wing ones, was so pro-war. I notice you're not in the Army fighting. I got four cousins in the Army fighting. So when I argue against the war, I got a personal connection. Because those soldiers in the war of all colors and genders and sexual orientation, their lives are just as precious as the innocent Iraqis who often have to bear the cost. We're talking about the equal value of each life across the board. You keep track of that. You see. And then there's the dogma of escalating authoritarianism. The truncated discussions in our public life. We just had two conventions of the two parties, right? The milquetoast Democratic Party, infomercial for John Kerry, who's yet to find his voice. He found his voice in 1971. I don't know what's happened since then. Part of it is that he's become part of a political system that's characterized in part by legalized bribery, normalized corruption, and institutionalized graft. And he doesn't have the courage to tell the American people the truth about how corrupt the very system that he's a part is. Reminds one of the Grand Inquisitor of Dostoevsky's great novel in that prose poem, The Grand Inquisitor of Brothers Karamazov. He knows the system's corrupt, doesn't want to tell the truth about it, and thinks he can find some wiggle room. And I believe in wiggle room, no, don't get me wrong. But you will lose the respect and trust of fellow citizens if you don't tell them the truth that you know. And one of the reasons why 51% of our fellow citizens do not even participate in the political system is not, like old brother Sean Hannity said the other night in the debate with me, because they're lazy. And they're not stupid either. No, they're not. Well, there might be a few stupid ones, brother. Now, I understand that. Absolutely, absolutely. But most of them are fed up. They're disillusioned. They're disengaged with a system that they know is disproportionately shaped by corporate interests and powerful lobbyists, and they feel as if their voices really do not make a difference. And when you're working hard the way the mass majority of Americans are, trying to make it from womb to tomb and make sure that their children are on the right track, then they don't have time to mess around with corrupt systems like that. So they don't vote. Now, I think that's short-sighted. But I'm not going to run and tell fellow citizens you ought to vote for a candidate because your life is going to qualitatively change because everything is at stake. Much is at stake, but not everything. And it's true that I, of course, as you can imagine, I'm very, very close to my dear brother Ralph Nader. Supported him in 2000. He's been an exemplary citizen. No doubt about that. And I plan to pray for him this year, but not vote for him. Because even a milquetoast Democratic Party with Howard Dean and especially the young folk, disproportionately young fellow citizens injecting some energy into that party, is part of a anti-Bush united front. And even those milquetoast neoliberals have a role to play.